Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As Turkey Day unfolds tomorrow, retailers and manufacturers are preparing for a feast of their own. But in order to spend, shoppers need jobs and money, credit and confidence. Consumer spending is the backbone of the U.S. economy. In the post-90s bust, it turned into a life raft. Interest rates have been mercifully low, and many people got a boost from refinancing their home mortgage, but that didn't come back to haunt you. The latest economic growth numbers were sizzling, but most people won't forget the pinch of the downturn for some time. Tonight on Point, measuring the strength of the consumer engine in the American economy now. Are you planning a five-star shopping spree this end of year or something more modest? What's your personal consumer confidence level? Are you in spend more mode or save more mode? And what's your economic prognostication? Are you still hunkering down or smelling good times on the way? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin with a frontline look at retail expectations as the country heads into the holiday season. Joining me now from Glenview, Illinois, is Buzz Kaler, owner and manager of Kaler Travel Works with 14 stores in the Chicago area. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Kaler.
Hello, how are you?
We're real well, thank you. So your stores sell mainly luggage, is that right?
Well, we're in the travel goods business. Luggage is our mainstay, but we sell anything that you would put articles into travel, business cases, handbags, and all the travel accessories that would go with it.
And for the past couple of years, the holiday season has not been great, as I understand it. Is that right?
A lump of coal.
Why?
Oh, actually, because of the travel business. September 11th, of course, was devastating to the travel business. Mm-hmm. And the luggage sector is tied, you know, at the arm and ankle to travel and what happened to the airlines. So it's been tough going for the last couple of years with terrorism and whatnot, wars, SARS, everything else came to hit us at once.
Nothing really working for you. So there you are in the heart of the country, the heart of the economy. What are you expecting for this end of year season, 2003?
Well, we're actually very excited. This year, our stores, after the war basically was wound down starting in May, our sales have been really excellent and growing, and the trend has all been positive. So that leads us to believe that Christmas is going to continue on and be our best Christmas in a couple of years.
And are you backing that up with larger inventories, Buzz Kaler? Do you have more stuff on hand?
We are loaded, and that's why this is so exciting. You know, other years we've been very cautious and just putting enough on the shelves to get by. But this year we've really stocked up. We have our stock rooms are totally full. We've hired more people than we've had in the last couple of years. So we're really excited about this year.
Now, you know that retailers did that last Christmas season and then got hammered and ended up having to slash prices all over the place. The sale signs were up well before Christmas. Do you run that risk here?
Well, retail always runs the risk, and sometimes you shouldn't believe what you read in the papers. We didn't have the feeling last year that we have this year. We did not go overboard, and because we had gotten caught the year before with extra inventory and spent January and February trying to sell it off. And so we were very cautious last year, and it was okay. It wasn't, it was fine but not exciting. But this year we truly feel, because of the past few months have been good, that it'll lead right into this holiday season.
So you're looking at those mounting figures in recent months. How else do you put your finger in the wind? You've got 14 stores. You must have a pretty good nose for this stuff.
It's just what customers, when they come in and buy, one thing at a time and just what they need, versus when they come in and buy the one thing they need plus three other things, then you know that you've got something going and the consumers are feeling pretty good. And it's coming off, again, a sluggish time where people were cautious. But we really feel that lately the customer is back and has a good feeling going forward. Their stock portfolios are starting to gain again. They're feeling the wealth come back. Interest rates being low has been a great bonus.
So it looks like all the stars are lining up from where you sit.
Well, we feel so, but again, we're coming out of the travel business, which was much
harder hit.
So our feeling of recovery is, you know, based on coming off of pretty low numbers, but it does feel very good.
Mr. Kaler, we wish you good luck in this season.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You bet.
Buzz Kaler joined us from Glenview, Illinois. He's owner and president of Kaler Travel Works. They've got 14 stores in the Chicago area, plus a web retail store, and they are ready to rock in this holiday season. But will the consumers be there with them? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Are you feeling fat and sassy, ready to spend, or are you hunkering down this season? I'm joined now from New York by David Leonhardt. He's finance and economics reporter for the New York Times. David, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Great to have you up there. Jack, you can probably hear Santa's elves hammering from that northern location.
Yes, I can. Hello to our guests.
David Leonhardt, we want to take the pulse of the consumer tonight. They floated the boat of this economy through some pretty dark months and years recently. Now we're told things are firing up on more cylinders. How do you see that consumer sitting going into the shopping season, going into what's supposed to be an economic recovery year?
I think it's unlikely that the consumer is going to be the cause of any kind of large amount of distress. I think the consumer engine is going to keep on puffing, in brief. But the consumer is also a pretty good microcosm of the economy as a whole. It's unlikely to fall apart, as some people feared as recently as this summer, but it's also unlikely to boom in any way that will make us think back to the 90s. It's just the problem is people have bought too many cars and too many houses and too many appliances and too many you name it to have the typical post-recession bounce back that we once had after downturn.
Well, place this all in context of the bigger economic picture for us. These new numbers out just in the last day or two that the third quarter growth was not only 7.2%, but actually 8.2%, really torrid growth. The word we get is that businesses are pumping up their inventories, but still not keeping up with demand, and they're not finished restocking. That's a whole new element here. Corporate profits way up, and the Conference Board reporting that consumer confidence is up by 10 points in November. That all seems like a lot. Whether or not it's a 90s boom, those numbers look impressive.
They do look impressive, and I thought the most interesting thing that Buzz said was, we didn't have the feeling last year that we do this year, and you hear that a lot from business people. Business people really have been some of the most sober and accurate economic forecasters over the last few years. Wall Street economists keep predicting good times just around the corner, good times just around the corner, good times just around the corner, and they've been wrong repeatedly. But executives have been much more circumspect, and they've been right. And now they really are starting to change their mind a little bit. The issue isn't so much how rapid growth gets in one quarter, although that was obviously good economic news. The real question is, does it continue to the point where businesses will actually decide that they need to buy new equipment, that they need to hire new workers, and that they need to make changes that will get us on some sort of self-sustaining recovery? What we've had so far is a very good start, but it's also largely the result of government stimulus, the tax cut, and the low interest rates you mentioned that can't really be repeated.
Let's look at this shopping season coming right up. Apparently last year Americans spent something like $649 on average on gifts and decorations and holiday food on that. It's supposed to be up to $672 this year. Retailers, as Buzz Kaler said, think they've got a good thing coming. And as somebody wrote recently, heaven knows they need it. Last holiday season was the worst in a decade. Retailers make, 25, 30, 40% of their sales in this last portion of the year. Do you see a good year for them there?
The funny thing about retail is whatever you predict now, you can probably claim that you were right in a month because there are so many different measures of it that one stat will say this was almost as bad as last year, and the next stat will say, you know, this was much, much better. But apart from the individual numbers, I think this holiday season will be better than last year. But again, I think it'll fall short of some of the most optimistic predictions because of what I mentioned earlier.
Does that mean that retailers, David Lienhart, may be pushed back into that slashing prices before Christmas? I mean, we see a different kind of plan this year, sort of early sales and then the sales to be cut off. Sears, Best Buy, Radio Shack, all opening early on Friday, or at least Sears and Best Buy, for these early bird sales. And then we're told they're going to try and put the prices back at full price and hold the line there right through to the holiday.
Yeah, it's almost like they're imitating the airlines, right? Act early or pay a lot. I think sales, because of the low cost of manufacturing in other countries and because of the pressure that Walmart has put on other retailers, I think sales are at this point pretty much a permanent fact of retailing. Whatever retailers say about wanting to get back to no sales, I think with relatively few exceptions, we will always have what retailers call a sale because they have to compete with low-cost companies.
The expectation is really there. We see this American Research Group out of Charleston, South Carolina, did a survey, found that consumers want 50% off. That's what they're looking for. That's their buy button.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it has gotten to the point where some retailers will mark something up and then mark it right back down so they can say that they did. But in an overall sense, gimmicks aside, there isn't going to be a whole lot of pricing power for companies anytime soon.
Jack Beattie, what do you feel out there across the great nation? You know, people coiled to spend like gangbusters or watching warily here?
Well, you know, one is supposed to get with the spirit and say this is all about the pursuit of happiness, and that's great that we're all consumers and we're going to make a great recovery and so on. And yet, you know, it's true today that there are more shopping centers in this country than there are churches and synagogues. And it's interesting when you compare the role the consumer plays in our economy and how important it is. And
well, did you everything. Did you say more shopping centers than churches and synagogues combined?
Yes.
Wow, that's hard to imagine.
Well, I'm quoting from a source, Robert E. Lane, "The Loss of Happiness in Market Democracies." And Mr. Lane has a passage here where he talks about what people over the years have thought about consumption, and he quotes one anthropologist: "It fosters hedonism and a rage to consume. It undermines its own work ethic by replacing it with a consumer ethic." That's Daniel Bell. "It encourages invidious comparisons." That's Thorsten Veblen. "It makes a fetish of money." That's Marx. "Because a consumer's happiness is thought to be purely relative, it leads to insatiable striving." Hobbes, Machiavelli. "And it stimulates the appetites by each increase in wealth." Durkheim. So all the
good
great
Lord,
thinkers,
the malls are emptying as you speak, Jack. They're headed back to the church.
So all the great thinkers are as one as saying this ain't the route to happiness, folks.
Well, it may not be, but David Lienhart, this has been for many, many, many years a sort of prime hallmark of how the American operation is functioning.
It has been, although survey data would back up all those quotes. I mean, if you look at survey data, Americans don't report being any happier than they were 30 years ago, even though we obviously are wealthier and consume a lot more than we used to be.
How important, though, is that despite all the philosophers' sticks and stones, that urge to consume? I mean, President Bush was very keen on it right after 9/11. As consumers were cited again and again in the last couple of years for putting some kind of floor under the economy's fall. Was that consumer staunchness or illusion or delusion, as Jack might have it, key to keeping the recession from being worse?
Absolutely. Unquestionably. I mean, had consumers cut their spending, which they did in every other previous recession over the last 40 years, but did not do so this time, we would have had a lot more job loss. We would have had more people falling behind on their mortgages and being thrown out of their homes and all sorts of bad things.
And what's your assessment of why that cutback didn't come?
That's a very hard question to answer in any kind of definitive way. I think the low interest rates you mentioned clearly played a role. People have been able to tap into the value of their houses, which have continued to rise, much more easily than they could have in the past. I also think it matters that we were coming off such a strong economy that we really were still feeling some of the beneficial aftershocks, if you will, of the late 90s. And that plays over into the politics of the 2004 election that we can talk about later if you'd like.
But, oh, let's absolutely do it. People still ready to live large. David Leinhart, Jack Beattie, please stand by. We're talking tonight about consumer confidence heading into the year-end retail season and the strength of the consumer engine in the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation. Are you planning a five-star shopping spree this end of year or something more modest? Are you headed to Jack Beattie's church? What's your personal consumer confidence level this year? Does the upturn in economic growth numbers have you breaking out the champagne or still breaking out the credit card? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about consumer confidence heading into the year-end retail season, the strength of the consumer engine in the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation tonight. Is your household flush with economic growth or still leaning on debt and the refinance? What's your prognostication for the U.S. economy? Are we over the hump? Are you still hunkering down or smelling good times? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with David Leinhart with the New York Times. He's a finance and economics reporter there, and our own Jack Beattie. We're joined right now from Glenridge, New Jersey, by Charles Steindl. He's senior vice president at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Good evening and welcome, Charles Steindl.
Welcome. Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us. You keep a very close track on how consumers are positioned, how they're situated financially. What do you see out there, Charles Steindl? Are consumers in position to be a strong piston in the economic engine here, or is there too much debt? Is the refinance boom past?
I think consumers are in good financial shape and can keep on increasing their spending at a reasonably healthy clip through the Christmas season and into next year.
And what's the source of that? We don't see enormous raises on the way in many fronts. Unemployment is still not down so far. There's still even fear in some quarters of job loss. What's the fuel in the tank?
Well, it's true the raises aren't enormous. They're in the order of 3% or 4% if you're doing well. On the other hand, prices aren't increasing much at all. So in real terms, after-tax terms, income is growing at a pretty strong pace. And when we look at what generates employment and jobs, that's what counts. We sometimes get a different perspective when we're talking to the business people who are, after all, concerned about how many dollars are crossing the till. And if prices are low, that holds down their sales volume. But the actual amount of quantity, of real quantity of goods and services produced depends on real income, and that's strong.
When you look at consumer circumstances over time, over a pretty good sweep of time, give us a portrait right now, Charles Steindl. How are American citizens as consumers doing as a sort of household profile financially? How's it look?
Again, it's pretty strong. The interesting thing about consumer spending, when you take a broad look at it over time, it's really in some ways very unexciting. Real consumer spending tends to grow 3% or so year after year after year. The late 90s boom that Dave Leinhart was talking about, that was a few years of growth at 4%.
Mm-hmm.
That was the boom. Instead of 3%, you had a few years at 4%. Then we faded back down, maybe 2% or so for a year. Now we're back up to a 3 or 4% pace.
So we're not looking at wild swings here, though.
We're not looking at wild swings, but it's two-thirds of the economy. So even a little ripple in this area has important ramifications.
When it flattened off at that 2% last year, there was an awful lot of screaming about it.
Yes.
But even if the swings aren't great, there's a big difference in what people are buying, how much they're buying. I mean, there's a sense of a difference that the consumer confidence charts go after.
Well, yes, there is, of course, difference in buying. There are differences in retailing pattern. I was amused by Jack Beattie talking about, more shopping centers and churches and synagogues. Well, you know, the way the government counts the data on consumer spending, if you give to your church or synagogue, that's consumer spending.
Oh, you can't avoid it, Jack.
You can't avoid it. It's counted in good deeds are consumer spending as well.
So that's what the president meant. Pass the plate.
I can't speak to that.
Pass the plate. David Leinhart, well, I'm curious about your comment that the kind of high expectations of the 90s and their play out through the recession is somehow still going to be a dynamic that's active in the 2004 elections. Fill that picture out for us.
Sure. And it's not just the expectations. It's also the fact that the 90s left a lot of people with a lot more money than they had previously, either because of the stock market or home values, which have continued to rise. If you look at pretty much any broad poll that attempts to assess the national mood, the consumer confidence surveys, the Gallup surveys are you better off than you were, what kind of life do you expect for your children, they show that people are clearly a lot less happy and satisfied and optimistic than they were 5 years ago. But people are a lot more optimistic than they were a dozen years ago. And a dozen years ago is obviously the point of comparison that a lot of the Democrats who are up in New Hampshire right now have been making. They've been trying to compare Bush 2 to Bush 1. And apart from the issue of whether the current president deserves any credit for the economy or any blame for it, it's just clear that people aren't as upset as they were a dozen years ago. The University of Michigan does some of the best polling, and they say, they ask people, which would you say is more likely, that in the country as a whole we'll have continuous good times during the next 5 years or periods of widespread unemployment and depression? That's a pretty grim question.
Yes.
In the second half. But a dozen years ago, 23% of people forecast continuous good times over the next 5 years. And now it's up to 43.
How do you interpret that? That's an enormous difference. Is that a kind of lasting legacy of having seen the 90s, of having seen the economy unbound and all that intergalactic growth?
Well, Charles mentioned that after inflation, incomes are still growing a little bit. That affects people. Home prices, as I've mentioned, affects people. Interest rates affect people. The fact that the stock market, for all its bubble bursting, is still twice as high as it was in 1995 affects people. And so, I mean, I think what we're looking at in very basic terms is that while the economy was a very clear negative for the first President Bush, it is likely to be in its current condition, it's likely to be something of a wash for the second President Bush.
A kind of underlying buoyancy there. Let's hear from our listeners. We're talking tonight about consumer confidence, and you, Alan's calling from West Townsend, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. I'm on a cell phone, so forgive me for getting out here, but I just wanted to, just weigh in on a couple of things. Number one, in a real sense of terms, because of unemployment and layoffs and what have you, I make right now probably less than I made 20 years ago.
In constant dollars?
In terms of real dollars,
okay,
yes.
Okay.
My wife's a school teacher. She has to work two jobs. I am basically part of the... I guess there's a great majority of us right now that are underemployed.
All right.
You know, we're working, but we're working in industries that, we've basically taken a large step backwards. And as I mentioned to your screener, too, we recently refinanced, and basically we had to do that simply because the unemployment period wiped out the cushion that we had built up. In other words, we did everything right.
So you had to pull equity out of your house to stay afloat.
Exactly. I mean, we weren't in danger of losing our house. We managed to pay our bills while I was unemployed. I did some consulting, worked some retail jobs, that sort of thing.
Your income's been flat, and it doesn't feel like such a recovery to you. So as a consumer, are you still holding back?
Oh, most definitely. I've got a sophomore in college, and another one who's graduating from high school this year. We have to take loans out to take care of that. So. It's going to be a lean Christmas.
Alan, we've got the picture. Good luck with it, and thank you for your call. Charles Steindl, how about that? I mean, this is a story we read frequently in the media, people whose incomes have fallen after unemployment or who feel threatened by, job competition abroad, the sense of foreboding that I'm not really hearing in the numbers that you're sharing. How do you make these puzzle pieces match up?
Well, absolutely. There are many cases like the caller around the country. And the interesting point was he refinanced his home, and he's able to provide that as a cushion to at least prevent a more serious cutback in his spending.
Right.
There are economists who've studied that, economists at the University of Michigan, Frank Stafford, and feel that's been an important support to spending to people like that, this refinancing. And that wasn't available 20 years ago. That's a modern phenomenon. That's a development in the financial markets.
Is that all tapped out now, by the way? Is the refinancing wave pretty much behind us, or is it still an option for people?
Refinancing has cooled off because interest rates have tended to level off, but there still is a tremendous amount of untapped home equity in the United States.
David Leinhardt, respond to that caller as well. And you know, the storyline that's out there is not such a buoyant one on many fronts. Despite the high growth, you still hear plenty of people saying we're living with uncertainty. We don't feel that we've really surged ahead. Americans just, I don't know, are they greedier or are they misinterpreting their own circumstances?
No, I think there are hundreds of thousands and probably millions of households out there like Alan. It is clear that for a whole host of reasons, the migration of manufacturing overseas, the increasing efficiency of companies, that there are a lot of people out there who were able to make a good middle-class living 20 years ago, was his point of reference, and it's a good one, for whom it's much harder to do so today. They tend to disappear in the macro numbers, or at least are obscured in the macro numbers by some of the late 90s strengths we talked about. Mm-hmm. But before we get too complacent about the economy and say that, well, his story is largely an exception, I think it's worth pointing out that it depends somewhat on frame of reference. He again used 20 years, and the only time over the last 25 years that incomes were rising more quickly than inflation for the average American worker was the late 90s and into the early 2000s. And the question is, can that continue without a big stock market and technology bubble? And the hope is that it can, but that really is arguably the biggest uncertainty that hangs over the economy from the standpoint of average people.
And Jack Beatty, I'm curious what you make of the numbers that David Leinhardt cited from Michigan, saying that it was something like 23% who had the more confident view a dozen years ago. Now that up to 45% or so, a much more optimistic view under George W. than under George H.W. Bush.
Yes, and yet I've seen figures that say that the number who say the country is worse off or heading in the wrong direction has markedly increased, especially since the Iraq imbroglio began. And that's a sort of pessimistic metric. The question our caller raised, Alan raised, really is what I think is the long-term specter haunting this consumer economy, and that is a crisis in purchasing power. I mean, after all, I think I'm right, and I heard on the radio, NPR the other day, that
must be right.
It has to be correct that that personal bankruptcies are rising, if not at a record rate. And we all know that the fixed costs of life go up every year. Alan mentioned education. I went to school that paid $500 a semester. I mean, you can't get a sandwich at a college for that. And of course, in a country where Walmart is the representative corporation, this is a low-wage economy. Every year, people have to pay more for their own medical insurance. Nothing is being done to lower the cost of health care. Pensions, they are getting lighter. There's essential insecurities of employment because of globalization and technology. You know, in the 1950s, the economy or a retailer could look ahead and say, my gosh, real wages are going to go up 37% this decade. In 1960, he could look ahead and say, they're going to go up 41%. Nobody thinks that's going to happen over the next 10 years. And eventually, this low-wage economy, I think, is just bound to collide with the imperative to consume. We just ain't got it.
Charles Steindl, you know that picture. It's not hard to find it. How does it jive with the numbers?
Well, I can get into a long discussion about how one measures real income because it's a very controversial measure. And I don't think it would bore everybody if I started talking about the numbers. But the general belief is real incomes are growing. There are questions, I think, undoubtedly about the distribution of income. When we talk about typical Americans, people like our callers, many people have suffered hard times even over the last 10 years, even in the boom in the 1990s. And I think that's unquestionably true, and that's a problem and that's a concern. This, I'm afraid, from where I sit, I look at the broad averages. The broad averages still show growth, not that different from the boom times of the 1950s and the 1960s, which I think are seen in somewhat of a false golden glow nowadays. And so I believe things continue to move generally broadly upward.
Got to sort this out. I want to welcome to our conversation from Columbia, South Carolina, Walker Smith. He's president of the Yankelovich Partners, a research and consulting firm that studies consumer behavior, attitudes, motivations. Good evening and welcome, Walker Smith.
Thank you much.
Thanks for being with us. First, just your top line this season. How does the consumer look? Robust, healthy, confident, or something else?
Well, I think it's kind of in the middle. Certainly, I think we'll see a better year this year in the holiday shopping season that we've seen in the past couple of years, but even that won't be a very robust year. The last couple of years have been relatively weak. When we look in our data, we continue to see a consumer that is very anxious about the future, very concerned about their personal financial situations. It's a concern that is always relatively high, but has become particularly intense in the last couple of years. In fact, the levels that we have measured are the highest we have ever seen just this year in 2003. So it's certainly a consumer that is more cautious about their own situations. We like to sort of remind people that anxiety is the undercurrent to the consumer mood nowadays. Whatever else you see in the consumer mood, you have to examine that within the context of this low-grade fever of anxiety that people feel.
And how do you trace the roots of that anxiety, Walker Smith? Jack Beatty talks about a crisis in purchasing power. What are the root system there?
It's a whole pile of things that have really occurred in the last few years. It's all the scandals that people are seeing. It's the worries about terrorism. It's concerns about safety nets and budget deficits at state and local levels. It's even new things just in the last few months, concerns about people's health, issues that are new on the radar screen. And then you add to that concerns about unemployment, concerns about people's ability to afford the things that they're looking for, and you have a level of anxiety that is pretty acute.
And Charles Steindl mentioned distribution of income as a key piece here. What about that? Do you see the country kind of sorting out into those who have no worries and those who have a lot?
Well, you see this anxiety present really at all income levels, but it's clear that the anxiety is strongest among people who have access to fewer resources. So they have a smaller network of friends. They have less income. They have less access to other kinds of networks or resources, and that tends to be minorities, it tends to be women, it tends to be younger people, and it tends to be lower-income people. And so you certainly see that kind of income effect sorting itself out in the kind of anxiety you see in the consumer mood nowadays.
And what about the big middle? Are retailers still pointing at that, or are they trying to point upscale and find that loaded consumer?
Retailers are getting pretty savvy about the disappearance of the middle market in the American economy. There really is no opportunity for growth in the middle market anymore. You're either a discounter or you're a specialty retailer. And that's true really in every consumer category nowadays. People don't aspire to be middle class anymore. And that certainly was an aspiration that drove the middle market through the 1940s and the 1950s and the 1960s. We saw it begin to weaken then over the 70s and the 80s, and it disappeared as an aspiration in the 1990s. So there's not that opportunity.
And away it goes. We want to hear more from you, Walker Smith. David Leinhardt, stand by, and Jack Beatty. Charles Steindl, I know we have to let you go, but thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Charles Steindl is Senior Vice President at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. We're talking tonight about consumer confidence heading into the year-end retail season. Are you in spend more mode or save more mode? Are you roaring into the malls this weekend? What's at the top of your shopping list? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about consumer confidence heading into the big year-end retail season and the strength of the consumer engine in the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation tonight. What's your personal consumer confidence level this year? Is your household flush with the new economic growth we saw in the third quarter? 8.2%? Wow. Or is it still leaning on debt and the refinance? What's your prognostication for the U.S. economy? Are we over the hump? Are you still hunkering down or smelling good times? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by New York Times finance and economics reporter David Leonhardt, joining us from New York. From Columbia, South Carolina, by Walker Smith, president of Yankelovich Partners. Jack Beatty's with us, and you can join the conversation as well. Ryan's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hello. My consumer confidence this year is, as over the past couple of years, has been kind of lower. I'm looking at probably anywhere from about $10 to $20 for spending on family members and other such people for Christmas over the holiday season. I'm in manufacturing. I'm an apprentice toolmaker, and I've watched my father's business go from very, very good down to dwindling and starting to pull through. But
is your father also in tool making, Ryan?
Yes, he owns his own company.
And do you work in your dad's business?
I had worked for him for about 2.5 years, and unfortunately shortly after 9/11, again, I ended up laid off from the company. So
laid off from your father's company?
Yes.
That's rough, but you're still an apprentice and in the business. What's eating away at it, Ryan? Is it low demand? Is it foreign competition?
It's a lot of it, I believe, is foreign competition, really. I think China plays a large part, and the government, I think, is a couple years too late on the taxes and tariffs. I'm 30 miles away from Meadville, Pennsylvania, which is tool and die capital of the world, and I was watching in horror as, 38 shops were foreclosed on in a week's time. And, I mean, that's really scary looking at being 23 years old, building my life up over a period to become a tool and die maker, to watch what essentially I'm building for dwindling away.
Ryan, stick with us for a minute here. David Leonhardt, what's your message to Ryan? He's going to spend $10 or $20 on Christmas gifts this year, and he's worried about his whole industry melting away right under him.
It is an unfortunate but sensible worry to have. I mean, one of the real problems that we've got is that we have large numbers of people who have trained for one kind of economy, some of whom are 23, some of whom are 53, and now find themselves facing a very different one. And I won't claim to be able to offer him any specific advice, but I think it's clear that whichever way the economy goes, as a society, one of the biggest decisions we are going to have economically is how we help the large numbers of people in manufacturing and other industries who are not going to be in a great position to benefit from the direction the country's headed in.
And Walker Smith, speak to Ryan's circumstance as well. You tap the mood of a lot of people. Is he out in an isolated rivulet, where in just a particularly tough competition sector from abroad, or is this a common fear? And what about the notion that it's just going to be a different kind of economy, and Ryan, hey, lucky he's young and 23, he'll have to change?
Well, I certainly think that's a large part of what people are concerned about nowadays, is their inability to foresee the future. You know, the future looks kind of cloudy and murky to people nowadays, and that's really in contrast to the way the future appeared to Americans in 1998, 1999, even, say, 1964. People don't have a clear sense of the future nowadays, and there are a lot of reasons for that. Certainly, competition from abroad, concerns about where certain industries are headed, creates that uncertainty, and that worries a lot of people and makes people more cautious about how they participate in the marketplace. So I certainly don't think this is an isolated feeling. This is something that is shared by most Americans nowadays.
Ryan, what's your game plan? You're 23, tool and die is facing an awful lot of competition from abroad. Are you going to stick with it and hope for some kind of cover from the government, from tariffs, or do you think you might have to consider getting a whole new career?
Well, quite honestly, I'm really looking towards going back to school for business simply because I've got a long ways and a long road ahead of me. I'm engaged at the moment, and I got to look towards providing for myself and a family in the future. And I'm looking to honestly go back to school for business because I figure there's always going to be the need for somebody to sell something from a foreign country.
Some kind of country. From a foreign country. Oh, yeah. Lord, you'll be a middleman. Well, we wish you luck with that, Ryan, and good luck with the big transition. Be happy you're 23, I guess, is the message from these guys. Walker Smith, I want to ask you about something. Thanks for your call, Ryan. Walker Smith, David Leinhardt earlier quoted a survey, and David, you may have to bring this back to us to make it accurate, but that found that, well, David, give it to us again. The one that found confidence so much higher now than in the 1988-89 period Walker Smith was talking about when things were less cloudy.
Absolutely. So in late 1991, 23% of people surveyed by the University of Michigan expected continuous good times over the next 5 years. And now the number is 43%. And I will add a third data point for perspective. In late 2000, it was 61%.
Walker Smith, how do you interpret that?
Well, the anxiety that people feel doesn't have anything to do with whether or not they feel optimistic or pessimistic about the future. And we're drawing this distinction a lot for our clients when we talk to them about how to assess their own prospects.
But continuous good times sounds like optimism.
In our data, we find 80% of Americans are very optimistic about the future. There's no question that on a long-term view, people are very optimistic. But on a more short-term view, people are very anxious. I liken this sometimes to the approach of a hurricane. We all know when the storm passes, blue skies will return. But what we're worried about right now is the next 12 hours and whether or not we're going to be one of the survivors to enjoy those blue skies when the storm has passed. And so what we do is we hunker down, we protect ourselves, we don't expose ourselves to risk. And that's how consumers are acting in the economy nowadays. Notwithstanding their optimistic view of the future, they are worried about their immediate prospects, and that's what's having the most impact on how they're behaving in the economy.
Well, that's you work a lot with these numbers. I have to say, it's still kind of a confusing juxtaposition for me. Jerry's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm really surprised by the University of Michigan study, and I disagree with the gentleman who just said that people's anxieties seem to be in the near term or medium term. I'm hearing so many comments from well-educated professionals, very experienced people who are wondering, how am I going to retire, let alone have the money for the upcoming holiday season? So I would like to know who the people were that were polled in the University of Michigan poll, because I'm not hearing that at all. I find that the anxiety is pervasive. I think that we need to think about that anxiety in terms of linkage to other issues and other data we're seeing in terms of health issues, the number of people on antidepressants. We talked about the bankruptcy rates earlier. I think it's widespread, and I'm really surprised by those poll results.
And yet there's that number, and Michigan's awfully respected. But, Jerry, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, jump in here with your interpretation for us. Do we have here something about the, I don't know, native optimism of Americans struggling against certain facts on the ground, as they might say?
That could well be, and maybe the three stages of it, 23% expect good times in 91, 61% in 2000, 43% today. Maybe that 43% represents what wasn't there in 1991, a whole technological revolution that really gave a lot of people hope and that we all recognize is going to make all of us more productive in the future. So it may be that we're not going to go back to that kind of low point anymore. Yet I do want to join with Jerry in feeling that this optimism over the long term, I'm sure that Mr. Smith finds it in the polls, and yet my sense of it is that just when we look at the objectivities, a federal budget deficit out of control, a foreign accounts deficit with international trade way out of control, a political system that whatever else it does doesn't seem to produce solutions for ordinary people, a war, terrorism. I'm just wondering where the heck can this optimism long term come from?
Walker Smith, you want to address that?
Well, sure. I mean, that's the lesson that people have learned from the stock market since the late 70s and the early 80s. You buy and hold for the long run. I mean, that's a lesson people have learned. So when people are asked questions in surveys about where things are headed in the future, a point in time that is disconnected from their present circumstances, the lesson they've learned is that things will improve. Things will get better. But again, the priority that they have is not to plan for the long term, but to address their immediate needs. And so what really concerns people the most are all of the pressures that they face today. And so this anxiety that I've described earlier and that we've been talking about is really much more the important factor here. And I think we would do well, as we encourage our clients to do, to kind of ignore what people have to say about the future. You know, that's kind of the life on Mars kind of vision, and to pay more attention to the kind of pressures that people are facing right now.
Ken's calling from Walpole, Massachusetts. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I remember hearing a lot of rosy talk by stock promoters, like for promoting Enron and whatnot, saturating the airwaves and trying to get people to invest and what. And I feel like I'm hearing it again on like ABC, NBC, and different places. Maybe here tonight. And also, I was up in canvassing in New Hampshire this past weekend, and we talked to independents and Democrats, and universally, the people we talked to want Bush out, though they want somebody else in, a Democrat, and they don't. It's not because of the war; it's mainly because of the economy.
Who were you canvassing for, Ken?
I was canvassing for the Teamsters for Gephardt.
And do you think that Bush is vulnerable on the economic front or not?
Talking to the people I talk, universally it is, yes.
Well, there's a view. Ken, thanks for your call. David Leinhardt, how about it? Ken thinks he hears rosy scenario talk again. Does it sound like a fair criticism to you or not?
The rosy scenario talk is certainly there again. You could argue it's always there, and it just looks for opportunities to come out. As I mentioned before, Wall Street has been far too optimistic about the economy. And I understand the caller's points and Jack's point about the anxiety out there. The economy by no means is good right now, and there are a lot of long-term concerns. Like the federal budget deficit, which is even worse than the official numbers suggest because of Social Security. There's a savings deficit within a lot of individual families because they've been spending, as we've talked about, and have not been saving as much as they likely need for retirement. But I guess I would encourage people to think back a little bit to the early 90s. To keep in perspective how things really are different this time. And it's not just those Michigan polls. You look at any poll, Gallup, Michigan, ABC, and they show the same things. In the early 90s, people's income had been growing slower than inflation for 15 or 20 years. In most parts of the country, their house prices hadn't increased at all or had fallen. There was a widespread fear that the U.S. was about to be eclipsed by Japan as the dominant economic power in the world. You compare that to today, and there really is no serious economic rival to the U.S. in the world. House prices have been increasing rapidly. China may be many years from now, but there isn't the fear that China's about to buy Rockefeller Center right now.
So what's your advice out of all that, David Leinhardt, to the consumer? Let the good times roll, get out there, or take care?
For individuals, and this may not be the best advice for the economy as a whole, for individuals, I think it's probably to save more. I think when you look at the numbers, it's pretty clear that people aren't saving enough for retirement and that the government isn't either. And so that leaves more of the retirement burden on individuals.
And Walker Smith, how about yourself? I know the corporations pay you to figure out how to get people to come out and buy, but what's your advice to individual consumers, citizens?
Well, again, I think it's a bit of the same advice. It's to try and keep things in perspective and to be a little bit cautious with their finances. I think David makes a very good point about the prospects that people were facing at the end of the 80s and the very beginning of the 1990s. It is important, though, I think, to bear in mind the context within which people make these assessments. And so today people are making assessments with the memory of 1998 and 1999, not with the memory of 1991 and 1992. And so while their assessments aren't as bad as they were in 1991, that's absolutely true on every survey that's continuous over that period of time. They nevertheless do feel a high level of anxiety because their point of comparison is different. And relative to that point of comparison, I think you do see people wanting to save more money, spend more time with first priorities. And first priorities now, to Jack's point at the very beginning of your show, are all about some of the intangibles these days.
Sounds like it may be a good instinct. Walker Smith, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Great having you. Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. And David Leinhardt in New York, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
David Leonhardt, finance and economics reporter for the New York Times. Jack Beatty, I'm sure that you're chomping at the bit to get out to the mall on Friday.
Yeah, Tom, I've got to go. Happy Thanksgiving to you and all our listeners.
Very happy Thanksgiving to you, Jack. Thanks for being with us tonight. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.